Indeed, indeed, with our special guest tonight, Richard Florida, his work, The Great Reset. Final hour of the program tonight, we're going to be talking about you, happiness genes, with a couple of experts. That'll be later on Coast to Coast AM. What do you see as these futuristic jobs and these companies that will help get this reset going again, Richard?
Well, I think we are going to create over the next decade, even in the recession, even before we're fully recovered, about 13 or 14 million new jobs. Now, tragically, we're going to lose another million jobs in the blue collar work that we talked about, that really were the backbone of this country. But we're going to grow about 13 or 14 million new jobs, and they're evenly split. Half of those jobs are good, high-paying jobs in business management, new technologies, infotech, biotech, software, medical technologies, and in the professions. Obviously, we're creating lots more jobs in healthcare and education, which are good, family-supporting, middle-class or upper-middle-class jobs. Mm-hmm. We're going to create another 6.5 to 7 million jobs. Low skill, food preparation, home health care aides, service work. And as we're talking about in the last hour, it's that 7 million jobs that somehow we're going to have to turn from barely living wage jobs to family supporting wage jobs. So our economy is, if it continues the way it is going, it will be a divided economy with half of the jobs we create being very good jobs and half the jobs we create being, less than good jobs, and the old good jobs that we have continuing to go away.
All right. Now, this is what also could happen in these jobs will have to allow them to be able to buy some things, appliances and things, I think, to get this country going again. What are the possibilities of doing away with the Internal Revenue Service, the income tax, in going to something else, giving these people the opportunity to use 100% of their money?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, and I think everyone listening in to your show, to this show, understands this, I think we're not looking at less taxes. I mean, when you look at the giant hole our government has dug with bailout, the banks,
and it's not
the
over.
Mortgage market institutions, the auto, everyone, and then the attempts to stimulate. I don't want to say there's anything wrong with trying to stimulate. Certainly better than bailing out. But by stimulating all the old economy things, building more roads, highways to nowhere, and of course some of our bridges need to be rebuilt, of course. But instead of building the infrastructure, we always would build the infrastructure of the future. When we needed to build electric power grids to provide electricity, we built them. Telephone systems to communicate, we built them. Roadway systems to move people around. We have to be building new infrastructure now. But I think going back to your point, George, we're looking at more taxes, not less. We're looking at, you know, proposals of new things, and who knows which ones will pass the Congress, like in addition to our income tax, a value-added tax. Our state, clearly our states and localities are broke. They bankrupted themselves. They do have to balance their budget, so that means they have to increase their taxes. So I think, unfortunately, instead of freeing up income for spending in the United States, the reality, and I read Rubini the other day, and I do admire the guy, and I think he's one of the people I turn to. You know, he said in a fabulous essay that what's the future of our dollar? You know, the backbone of the world economy, the backbone of our nation. He said there's two futures. We're either going to have to devalue it, or we're going to have a rate of inflation that's so great that it allows our global debts to decline, inflate or devalue. So it seems to me that, one, I do think we face higher taxes, tragically, but two, actually, what I really worry about and what keeps me up at night, many nights, is the state of our currency, which you know, it's hard to imagine the U.S. dollar coming through this unscathed, and an era of rapid inflation or devaluation isn't the kind of picture I think that most Americans want to entertain.
Paint us a picture of the next 5 years.
Well, I think we stay in this indeterminate period. As I said, I think we're better. I think we're better at managing economic difficulties than in the previous two resets, the late 19th century and the 1930s, but those were 30-year events. From trough to peak, from crisis to recovery, they were two- or three-decade-long events. So I think in the next 5 years, our economy, some days it looks good, some days the stock market's up, some days it's down. Some days the housing market looks like it's recovered, sometimes it's down. Sometimes consumer confidence is up, sometimes it's down. It won't be until we really begin to get back to building our real economy, our underlying innovation and technology system, and on with inventing a whole new way of living. And for folks listening in, I think there's some pretty basic elements to that, some pretty basic elements that have powered America in the past. One is this creation of new infrastructure. And, you know, I'm a big believer in high-speed rail. I'm a big believer in pricing our roads so they're not congested. But you don't have to believe in any particular thing. But, boy, oh, boy, one of the things that's powered recovery in the past is we have to make the velocity of moving people, goods, and ideas faster. That's what subways and cable cars did. That's what automobiles did. That's what airplanes did. And now, you know, we lose $100 to $200 billion a year just sitting in traffic. It's insane. The second thing that's undergirded recoveries is reinventing the way we educate and develop our people. And in the book, I say, the school system that we invented a couple of hundred years ago, mass public education, bringing kids to school at 8, sending them home at 3, worked great for the industrial age, gave factory worker kids like my dad with a 7th grade education the tools they needed to work and be literate in a factory. And then after the Great Depression, we expanded universities and colleges with the GI Bill. We have to completely reinvent our education system from the ground up. It's no longer just sending kids to schools. We have to encourage them to be innovative and entrepreneurial and creative. And then thirdly, the third thing we've done in the past, which I think is somewhat controversial and it certainly stirred a discussion in the country, is that we've always reinvented the way we house our people. And in the era after the Depression, we went from a country of 40% homeowners to a country of 70% homeowners, massively subsidizing homeownership. I think we've got to rethink this. And actually, I've done the research. I've looked at this every which way and up. And it's not like we're going to become a nation of renters again. But for too many people, a home, a single-family home, is a burden they can't afford. It's what skewed capital out of productive activity into the bubble. I'm finding when I look at cities and regions around the United States that are the most flexible, the most resilient, this is important. Places where the rate of home ownership is higher have lower incomes, lower wages, lower rates of innovation. And you were saying in the later segment you're going to talk about happiness. People are actually less happy. I think in this country, instead of the nation of 70% homeowners, we're going to have to get down what our most propulsive regions and cities have is about 60%, 55 to 60% homeowners. Those regions have more rental. People are, when downsizing or downshifting, they're easily able to shift their housing and go to a smaller unit. They can absorb new people quicker. So I think we're going to have to build new infrastructure. We're going to have to change our education system. We're going to have to rethink the way we house people.
Well, what
and
if we went?
That's
though,
only going to start to occur over the next 5 years.
What if we went to a concept though, where the person who could afford it ends up buying 5 little houses and rents them all out to those people who can't buy them?
Well, I actually think we have to go further, and I think you're right, George. But I think we have to go further. You know, I'm talking to you tonight, although we live in Toronto. I'm talking to you tonight from Miami Beach, and I'm actually looking over at the lit skyline of the city of Miami. And not only because it's dark out, but even at an earlier time in the evening, you would see many, many, many fully blackened but brand new condo towers. They were built on the thought that rich people from all over the world would come and buy second and third and fourth and fifth and sixth homes. And I look at them and they make me sad I can't understand how we can build such beautiful housing and have it go unoccupied. We have beautiful new suburban subdivisions all over this country that are abandoned, wonderful homes no one is living in. And why can't we figure out a way to roll those things up? And not just the independent entrepreneur has 5. Why can't we figure out a way to roll those things up, buy them at distressed sales, make them affordable? And this is already happening in some parts, even in Miami, where I am. The condos are being rebought by new investors and being turned into rental. And what they're finding is young people are moving in from the suburbs. Empty nesters are coming back into the city, and they're creating, but it's affordable rental. So I think when we have a, I don't want to call it a surplus of housing because everyone needs a great roof over their head. But when we have so much wonderful housing that is not being occupied and used, we can use it in a new way. We can create efficiency. And then what I hope someday, you know, if you get that transfer from Detroit to San Francisco or from Cleveland to Boston, instead of having to find yourself a whole new housing unit, you sign up with a company that has units in a variety of places across the country. And you get the rental you need. And finally, I was telling this story the other night to a group of people in Toronto, where we live part of the year. And a young woman came up to me and she said, I like this idea. She said, but we don't use the housing we have. She said, and we were talking about, you know, how when we went from a nation of car owners to a nation of car leasers, my dad wouldn't have understood leasing a car, but now so many people lease their cars. And she said, Zipcar. That was her response. But she said, you know, now people can use the car when they need it. They don't have to own it. And I think we have to revolutionize the way we house people, something along that line. Instead of having everybody, you know, the best financial advisors have said this: housing is an undiversified, illiquid investment. Is that really where you want to put the preponderance of your savings? So having someone else own the house, you using it and paying for it as you need it, and if you need to move, having flexibility, that's not for everybody. We're still going to have a nation of 55 or 60% owners, people who can own, need to own, are going to be in one place, should. But I think for many other people, we have to rethink the way we house people, and rental could be a way to go.
All right, here's something we really haven't touched on. How does this affect this entire plan, the reset? Another war, and a big war, Richard, and I think it's going to happen. They're going to have to do something in the interim to keep Americans' minds off problems, stress, and I think they're going to do it with a war. I really do.
Well, George, I'm not an expert in geopolitical affairs, but I can tell you this from having studied the previous two big resets. After one, we had a world war, and in the middle of the other one, we had a world war. They were periods of incredible domestic political instability. Some might say class conflict in our country, certainly in Europe, rampant class conflict throughout the country, capital and labor in pitched battles, the rise of fascism and totalitarianism, terrible things. And then giant contest over who would control markets and resources in the world economy. Now, if you look at the world today, it looks somewhat more stable. It certainly is, business is more intertwined. There's more cross-investment across borders. But on the other hand, if you look at the competition from resources, not only on behalf of our country, but the rise of China and this incredible essay that a fellow I know, Howard French, wrote in the Atlantic Monthly about China moving into Africa, the next empire, I think he calls it, moving into Africa in a powerful way. Oil resources being what they are, water resources for some places being what they are, I think one can imagine a scenario where the geopolitical rifts get much worse. I hope, George, it's not often I hope you're wrong, because I enjoy talking to you so much, but I tell you,
I hope I'm wrong.
It keeps me awake. It keeps me awake at night. It keeps me tossing in bed, because that's why I wanted to focus my book on what we need to strengthen our domestic economy. Because if this geopolitical system breaks down, I shudder to think in our time what another world war or another war between great powers would look like. I don't think we could survive it, or I don't see how we could survive it. But I think it is a time of heightened geopolitical stress. And in the past, it's been impossible to contain that stress in periods like this. So, you know, when we're looking a generation out, remember, folks, we're in the earliest stages of this reset. The world economy broke down in 1929. The Great Depression accelerated in the 30s. World War II didn't even start till the late 30s. The U.S. entered in the 40s. And then it wasn't recovering until the 50s. We are in the early innings, and my only hope is that we've reached a stage where we're somewhat smarter and more sophisticated and more dependent on one another, that we can't go down that road, that we rebuild our domestic economy and make it work. But I tell you, George, it's a thought that I entertain frequently, and it's a thought that scares me. And in the past, what you're saying has occurred.
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. Absolutely, indeed. The Great Reset. I'll tell you what we're going to do, because people are calling like crazy wanting to talk with you. I'm going to open up the phone lines a half hour earlier tonight. And so we'll talk with the folks at the half and then also all of next hour. But what I'd also like them to do is share with you that question you poised to, and that was the Great Reset. What are they doing to change things? And I think that's very important now, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to give a commencement address, and I actually like doing them. And the title of it is going to be Why You're Not Screwed. And what I'm going to tell the young people is, graduating from college, is, you know, guys, it looks bleak, and people are saying you're a generation that's broke and over your head in debt, and you're a lazy slacker generation, and all of you are going to go home and live in your parents' basement. But if you really think about your life now, the opportunities that you have to create your own little business, to be a freelancer, to work using the internet as your toolbox and your factory, you don't have to go and strap, like when I graduated college, strap yourself to the big corporate machine. There was not much opportunity to be a free agent or a freelancer. And yes, it's a time of difficulty and struggle. But if you're smart about it, if you don't go into that crazy debt, if you don't get on that treadmill of keeping up with the Joneses, and you've got to have that brand new house or luxury condominium and a big SUV in the driveway, if you stay in a rental apartment or team up with some other kids, pool your money. Maybe you don't buy a car. Maybe you depend on transit. And a lot of my students and research assistants are telling me, you know, they'll buy a bicycle or a darn scooter to get around. They don't want to be over their eyeballs in debt. I think it's a time that you can reset. And what I found through
the history. But reset, though. Let me ask you this real fast. Reset doesn't mean you're not living, does it?
No, it means you're living a life that I think you're resetting your life to be more fulfilling and passionate and to use your talents. And I think one of the things that really got me galled and got so many Americans galled about the boom period, our own Great Gatsby, 1920s-like period of the past years, was that people thought they could have fulfilling lives by buying stuff out of a department store catalog or online and buying more. And because they couldn't find a fulfilling life, because they couldn't live and do work they love like you and I have the good fortune to do, that's where I say this in the book. Our identity comes not from buying things and hyper-consumerism. Our real identity comes from doing things we love. And work that engages us and fulfills us. That's what I mean by resetting your personal life. And, of course, getting your house in order, making sure that you live within your means, making sure that you don't overspend yourself so you're not on that treadmill, you know, like the dog or the cat or the mouse running on that wheel trying to keep up. So that's when I mean a reset. I mean living a much more fulfilled and purposeful and engaged life. And living it perhaps in a very different way than our parents and our grandparents, but one that makes sense for us.
And that's from within, too. People need to dig deep within themselves to decide what they're going to do. And as you well know, having things doesn't make you happy. If anything, I think it makes you more miserable.
Well, that's what all the research, you know, of the greatest psychologists have found, is having things doesn't make you happy. Having close relationships, seeing people you love and care about and friends, doing work that's purposeful and engaging, and living in a place, in a community that you really resonate with, those are the things that bring true joy. And I think if there's any silver lining in this crisis, and by God, I wish it didn't happen, if there's any silver lining, is that it's forcing millions and millions and millions of Americans and people around the world to think that through.
And that's very, very important to do, Richard. Back with phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, after the program Friday night and the Saturday morning, I'll be popping on a plane. I'll be going on tour for the weekend. I'll be at the X Conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. If you want some information on that event, just go to our coasttocoastam.com website. Click the calendar section out at the bottom of the homepage down there on the left. When I come back, we'll take your phone calls with Richard Florida, author of The Great Reset, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Florida with us. Richard, Detroit, my hometown, born and raised there. It's a shell of itself. It's not the same. Will it ever come back?
It can. I think, you know, I have a whole chapter on the death and life of great American industrial cities in the book, The Great Reset. I think the one thing that this crisis has shown Detroit is that it can't rebuild around bailouts. Bailing out the auto industry isn't a solution for its future. And it can't rebuild around, you know, I've studied city development for a long time, around the crack, literally the crack of stadiums, convention centers, downtown, you know, tower building, and now the worst of all possible things, this era of casinos will solve all problems. So I think Detroit still has amazing innovation and creative energy. It has great colleges and universities like Wayne State. In the city, it has Cranbrook Academy. University of Michigan and Michigan State are very, very close by. In fact, they're almost in the outskirts of the greater Detroit region. And, you know, great musical innovation, you know, from Motown to Iggy Pop to the MC5 to the White Stripes and others. Great design and technology. So I think it forces it. But one of the things I found when I lived in Pittsburgh and before that when I lived in Boston, both cities that had to revitalize and renew, it took two generations. You know, Boston started to fall apart in the 50s. It wasn't until the 70s and 80s that it began to renew. Pittsburgh lost its economic way in the 70s, and it wasn't. And I moved there in the 80s. It's not till now that Pittsburgh is held up as a model of renewal. So I think the process of rebuilding is at least a generation long, and it can be done. But it's going to take getting away from federal bailouts, you know, federal solutions, big government programs, urban renewal, stadiums, and getting back to doing the day-to-day things, building up stronger communities, stronger neighborhoods, and real communities. I'll tell you what strikes me as odd, though, George, and I don't know how this strikes you, but when I hear people talking about turning Detroit into a giant urban farm, or worse yet, closing off neighborhoods and whole parts of the city, I worry. I worry when the strategy for rebuilding the greatest industrial city the world has ever known means turning it back into a farm or shutting down whole swaths of the city. I think we can do better. And I think, you know, we can, as one colleague put it, there are assets there that can be built around. There are things that can be done. It doesn't all have to be turned back into rubble and dirt and farmland. Some of that's okay, but I think there's enough asset. It's a big region, a great airport, lots of people, good universities, innovative spark, and yes, but it's going to take time to do it.
All right, let's go to some of the calls. We'll go west of the Rockies. Jackie is in Weezer, Idaho. I like that town, Weezer, Idaho. Go ahead, Jackie.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are
morning.
You tonight?
All great. Well, thanks.
I've got two questions for you. Short little story. In 97, we had a major flood here, and I had put in the furniture that I had that had gotten wet on the back patio. When it dried out, I repurposed it for my back patio furniture, which came in very handy, plus comfortable. Another thing is the barter system. I don't hear too many people talking about that nowadays.
Well, first of all, thank you for calling, and I think repurposing stuff and reusing stuff, however you can do it, is a great idea. We do find in neighborhoods and communities all over the country, one of the things I look at with my team is actually I try to get a sense of new evolving industries, and some of the most competitive and highly evolving industries in America are arts and culture industries. And in fact, the music industry, the creation of new bands, new music scenes, and that happened so fast and it's so diverse. We've been studying that almost as a way of looking at the broader economy and the evolution of these knowledge-based industries. What we're finding is tremendous amounts of bartering within the music economy, as bands are bartering services for one another, helping one another out, but also with fashion designers and graphic artists. Trey, you know, I'll play your gig or your show if you do my clothes or you do my graphic design. So Bartering as a very important part of how we're resetting, and particularly in arts and creative industry, lots and lots of it going on. And if it works for you, that's great.
Well, you know, there's a TV show out there called Hoarders, basically, and these people just hoard everything. I mean, everything.
I've seen it.
I wonder if people should start doing that again. Start saving everything.
Huh? Maybe reverse hoarding, actually.
Yeah.
I think part of resetting is letting go of things that maybe you have clinged to for too long. But that show is, I would say, part hysterical and part just deeply troubling.
Let's go to La Crosse, Wisconsin. Gene, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, good morning, Gene.
Good morning, George and Mr. Florida. An interesting name. It makes me think of the state. No offense intended.
Well, and he is in Miami.
Well, I guess the state's got your name on it. But what I actually called about is that I'm mostly disabled or handicapped, whichever you choose to call it, and I've been trying to find some way to supplement my bottom of the permanent commode income, which has left me where I keep going farther in debt, with seeing no way out and being harassed by collectors and trying to collect off of my Social Security and taste of SSI. And it's like, I need to supplement my income because there's too much of my medical is just, you know, parts of it that just are not covered. When if I could just get some kind of increase in my income, and it's like, what can a fella do in this economy? Because it's like, where do you turn? What kind of job can you get?
Yeah, and it's a situation that, first of all, thank you for calling, Jim, that too many Americans are in. And in fact, when you add up the cost of housing and energy and transport and then add healthcare, it's pushed too many people over the edge. It's what's caused a lot of the problems with debt. My own view on this is really simple, and it's the principle I've lived by, and I don't know if it works for everyone. I think the most important thing is to find the thing that you really love to do, and the thing that you really loved to do when you were a kid, and figure out a way to do it, and figure out a way to make it work for you, and figure out a way to do it as your own enterprise. And it may start slow, it may take a while to develop, but I think more and more Americans realize that taking a job, working in whether it's a factory if you're lucky enough to get one, or more likely in a service business paying the minimum wage or something close to that, isn't a strategy for security and survival. So the best thing you can do is try to create something of your own. So that's the strategy I always try to encourage people to undertake if they can, if there's any way, if there's something that you're passionate about, something that you care deeply about, to try to make a go of it that way, and create something that you own and aren't dependent upon others. It takes time. I mean, it certainly has taken us time to develop our little company, but if you can do it, it provides a level of security and purpose that you can't match. So that's what I would encourage.
Okay, great. Thanks. Baltimore we go. Hello, Tony. Take it away.
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing?
Great.
Glad to hear it. Let's see. I have a quick question. I guess my biggest problem is this. Okay. Now, you know how, like, when somebody comes up with a good idea and you have to worry about Uncle Sam or, you know, the people with the, you know, with the black suits on and stuff watching you if you come up with something too good.
You never know.
You know, do you think we're still going to have this kind of problems when this goes on? You know, if you got something and you're going to have to worry about somebody, you know, that's like, hey, well, if you think you want to develop that or try to do something with this, well, you know, we can always use more fertilizer in the ground if you get my drift. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure. I think with any new business idea, you want to protect your intellectual property. You want to take the proper precautions. You want to cover your bases, so to speak. But and there are a lot of hyper-competitive people. I'd be less worried about one's ultimate demise than you know. We live in a competitive country, and how many cases of somebody coming up with a great idea to find someone else, quote unquote, borrows it from them and turns it into their own. So it seems to me for innovative and entrepreneurial people, the first and most important thing you can do, and especially if you have a new technology or a copyrightable product or something that has intellectual property, is to protect that and to protect yourself. But I also think for folks listening in, I think Americans put too much emphasis on the technology or the idea. And, you know, my parents used to say to me, Richard, ideas are a dime a dozen. And, you know, Thomas Edison said, you know, invention is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. So one of the things I've learned in studying successful businesses, from successful startup companies to successful rock and roll bands and building a little business of our own, it really is execution and management and day-to-day blocking and tackling that matters. And unless you have that, you can't grow. So on the one hand, I think you have to protect what you have and make sure you cover your bases. But on the other hand, Americans have to realize that the key to success in building an enterprise, and I think this is why venture capitalists say all the time, you know, yeah, I like a great idea, but if you ask me, I really look at the quality of the management team, of the builders of this company, of the people who are going to run it. Having a great management team will trump having a great new idea every time, because so much of building a successful enterprise is about execution and staying the course and doing this basic blocking and tackling. So I think that's where we'd all be good to start.
Okay, thanks. Livermore, California. Mike's with us now on Coast to Coast. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George. Good morning, Richard. Take issue with you on a couple of things and a question. One of the things that you had said about new jobs that are coming up, two of them you mentioned, healthcare and education. I think that's a lot of our problem. And the root of it is too much government. It's expanded too much. The government has taken over education. The service industries, unions, and everything have demanded so much. Pensions are so high, it's driving us into the ground. And then now the new one's going to be healthcare, the same thing. So, sure, if we're going to expand the government, the taxes are going to go up to pay for that. One of the things in education that I like what you were saying is we need a new direction. We need to get away from the political correctness, the social engineering, and get into vocational and actually teaching people how to manage their money, the kids. That's one thing that we really lack. They don't know how to manage the money. As far as the taxes go, George, your idea of eliminating the IRS is great, and it can be done easily with a flat tax.
Yep.
That everybody pays the amount, and that will drive down the debt to some extent. Now, the one issue I want to take you with, and a question I have, is you say that we need to cut down home ownership. Well, the country was really, what made this country great was property ownership. And that's what makes us free, is property ownership. Now, if we go to rentals, with the baby boomers retiring and Social Security going away, how are these people going to pay for their rent? At least right now as it stands, if I retire and I own my house flat out, I'm paying property taxes, I might be able to survive on that.
And you're going to generally take care of your house. Rental folks generally don't have, you know, I know a lot of people who rent. They don't have it in them to fix up the place.
Exactly. And that goes to my, you know, what am I going to do about resetting? That's your big question tonight, George. I'm not going to do anything about resetting because I don't need to reset. When I bought my house, I bought what I could afford then. I have never moved. I bought a fixer-upper. I'm a handy guy. I'm a pack rat. I'm borderline hoarder. And I'll tell you what, it paid off over the years. I have neighbors who come to me and say, Mike, I'm looking for this. I'm trying to fix this. They don't have to go to the hardware store. I look at my garage, I find it for them,
you've got
and
it.
They get it fixed.
All right, how about your reaction here, Richard?
Well, first of all, thank you for those comments, and I think you're living your life. You didn't have to reset because you did your reset early on, and you lived a smart life within your means, doing things that you love and giving yourself purpose. A couple of things. One, I'm surely not saying that we should move to a society of renters, but we've gotten to the point where not 70% of Americans can afford to own their own homes. Where at least 10% of them, maybe 15% of them, shouldn't. So what I'm saying is if I look at the really, really super hyper-productive places around the country, they're not 70% or 75% home ownership. They're about 55 or 60%. People like you who buy within their means, keep up their houses, pay the house off, and then can live off it. But the people I'm talking about are not going to have any equity in their house to live off later because they couldn't pay for it in the first place, and they were defaulting to begin with. So I think it's more of a balance. It's not an either-or. It's a balance in what works. But the points about education and healthcare really resonate with me. And the reason is I've studied cities, and I've studied the cities that grow. And if you look across the United States, you'll see that almost every city now believes that its two driving pieces of its economy are education and healthcare. They actually have a buzz phrase for this, meds and eds. And I did say, and it's true, we're going to grow a lot of jobs. It's an area of job growth in meds and eds. It's a place we're going to add jobs. But one of the things we have to realize is that those jobs don't create wealth. We may need more teachers. We may need more healthcare professionals. They may be important to educating our children or when we are sick, getting healthcare. But across cities, those are not the jobs that add wealth. It's new technology jobs, it's new innovative jobs, it's even jobs in arts and culture that add wealth. The eds and meds jobs may be necessary and growing, but they're not wealth adders. And you said that. They're basically a creature of the government. So, but we're going to grow them, and they're going to continue to grow them, so maybe we have to figure out a way to turn them into more productive jobs. But I think the most important thing you're saying is that for folks to make it, they've got to figure out ways to live within their means. And create a lifestyle, and you're lucky. I hope other people have reset before, but for those who haven't, the crisis is making imperative for them to reset now.
Richard, my parents still live in the house that they bought for $13,000 back in 1958. They've been in there 52 years, and they raised us, and it's just truly amazing. They're still there. He's 87, she's 81, and it is amazing.
You're very lucky to have your parents still with you. Both my parents are deceased, but they live the same life. My parents bought their house in 1960. I think they might have paid in New Jersey $28,000 for their home. And my dad had that one job in the same factory. My mom worked a little bit part-time at the local newspaper, but came home to see us when we came home from school. Came home, left at 9 after we were gone. Was home by 2:30 or 3. We got home from school. And both of them lived their entire lives in that same house. One job, one house for life. You know, and here I am, and maybe I'm the exception, but, you know, I've moved 17 times since I went to graduate school in an attempt to find economic mobility and find jobs and latch onto a career, you know, from New Jersey to Ohio, to Pittsburgh, to Boston, to Washington, D.C., to Toronto.
You're almost like an affiliates list for our show, Richard, because we're all over the place, too. Hey, stay with us. We've got a final hour of phone calls with you. Those of you on hold from Florida, Phoenix, Toronto, Canada, Oregon, and the state of Washington, and all over the place. Stay with us. Don't lose your place in line. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.